Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a lecture entitled Desire and the Problem of Evil. This lecture is part of a series of lectures looking at the topic of evil presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion and sponsored by the Boston University Humanities Foundation and the Boston University Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. Speaking tonight will be Richard Carney, Selig Chair of Philosophy at Boston College and Visiting Professor at University College Dublin. Responding to Professor Carney will be Robert C. Neville, Professor of Philosophy, Religion, and Theology, and Dean of Marsh Chapel at Boston University. We begin with an introduction by Klaus Brinkmann, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Acting Chairman of the Philosophy Department at Boston University.
I have the pleasure to introduce to you our main speaker tonight and the respondent. These are two extraordinarily prolific scholars with wide-ranging interests reflected in their innumerable publications. Let me start with our main speaker today, Professor Richard Carney, who holds the Selig Chair in Philosophy at Boston College and is also a visiting professor at the University College in Dublin. Professor Carney received his PhD from the University of Paris, Dix, in 1980. His list of publications is most impressive, both in terms of numbers and in terms of the variety of topics addressed. Let me now turn to our respondent, Dean Neville. Dean Neville is currently Dean of Marsh Chapel and University Chaplain and Professor of Philosophy, Religion, and Theology. He is a member of the editorial boards of the Journal of the American Academy of Religion, of Soundings, Quarterly Review, as well as the associate editor for behavioral and neurological articles, something you might perhaps not expect, and of the Encyclopedia of Bioethics. Again, you see the immense range here in our speakers. Please welcome our two speakers. After Professor Carney's talk, we will move on immediately to the response, and then Professor Carney will have an opportunity to respond to the respondent. Professor Carney's topic tonight is desire and the problem of evil. Professor Carney, the podium is yours. Thank you.
So thank you for that generous introduction. Coming in the car this evening, I said to myself, you know, what would somebody expect from a title like Desire and the Problem of Evil? And I thought, well, you know, maybe something on the Marquis de Sade and Jack the Ripper or Les Liaisons Dangereuses or the novels of, or some novels of Updike or Philip Roth or something on the films like Blue Velvet and Cape Fear or various sadomasochistic.com websites or the red light districts of Rue Saint-Denis or Amsterdam or Rio de Janeiro and so on and so forth. And the bad news is I'm not going to be talking about any of those things, although they may indeed come up in discussion. I'm going to begin at the beginning, as I understand it, in terms of my limited competence, that is to say within the Western tradition, with two sort of formative stories about desire and the link between evil and desire, the biblical and the Greek. And then I want to, in the second part of the paper, answer that particular stigmatization of desire as evil with an alternative reading, also drawn from the biblical and the Platonic traditions, which seeks to open up another possibility of understanding. So to begin at the beginning, Genesis, where Yahweh in Genesis 6:5 says, I quote, "The desire in men's heart is evil from his youth." The root of evil is thus identified from the beginning in Genesis with the Yetzer as a carnal impulse buried deep in the human heart to possess and therefore replace the divine. In Christian theology also, we find a strong, perhaps even at times canonical, reading of desire in terms of evil. And it's probably no accident that Nietzsche made the famous remark that Christianity gave Eros poison to drink. One thinks here of a long lineage of suspicion running from the various patristic warnings against the demonic temptations of sexual desire to Augustine's famous analysis of desire as an evil lust of the eyes, what he called the concupiscentia oculorum. This was particularly in the Confessions. But in the Christian, as in the Jewish tradition, the desire is evil not primarily because it is some base animal instinct, but more interestingly, or more significantly, because it's a metaphysical drive to possess what is not ours. And in the most offending instance, what is absolutely not ours, that is divine power. At its most pernicious, the ocular erotic drive that Augustine speaks of takes the form of an obsessive curiositas with regard to absolute knowledge. I quote Augustine. "Such empty curiosity," he says, "is masked by the names of learning and science, but it is really just another name for what biblical language called the lust of the eyes." That's why the desire of the eyes, or inner eyes, fantasy and imagination, the two are very linked, is considered even more dangerous than the desires of sexuality per se, as a biological expression. For while acts of genital eroticism are confined to one person, or at least one person at a time, non-genital or metaphysical eroticism knows no limits at all. It's by its very nature limitless, megalomaniac, serial, endless. Hence the deep link between sinful eros and evil imagination in the biblical tradition, where the terms are even used at times synonymously. The Yetzer can mean either evil imagination or evil desire. Christ too has harsh words for the one who desires to commit adultery with the eyes, as in Matthew 5:27. If a man looks at a woman lustfully, he has already committed adultery with her in his heart. For here again, it seems, the worst form of desire is not that necessarily of carnal fornication, but of spiritual fornication, imaginative fornication, what Luther would call fornicatio spiritus, or the proud drive to dominate and appropriate what is another's as if it were ours. In other words, we're not talking here about physiological appetite, but mimetic craving. And those who wish to reduce the absolute other to a possession of metaphysical vision, visio dei, are, Luther says, the most egregious perpetrators of evil desire. I now want to move on to what I would call an affirmative reading. The first is the prohibitive reading, according to the hermeneutics of suspicion. This second reading, which is one that I'm going to endorse, is an affirmative reading, operating more in accord with what Ricoeur would call a hermeneutics of celebration. Here again, let's start with the biblical tradition. Having traced what I consider to be some of the most formative way stations in the genealogy of evil desire, I now turn to a very different, of often neglected, reading of desire in Western culture. This involves a hermeneutic of celebration, which can also be traced back, like its rival reading just mentioned, to the very beginning. So we'll start with the biblical sources. If it's true that several passages in the Torah and Talmud describe desire in terms of an evil inclination of the heart, there are other passages where desire is recognized as a positive and at times even indispensable agency of creation. When Yahweh, the Yotzer, first created Yatzar, humans, with the Yetzer, deploying the letters of the divine book of creation, the Sefer Yetzirah, he said that it was good. Indeed, the Yetzer was considered by some to be, some Talmudic and theological commentators, to be that image of the divine in the human, according to which Yahweh created us. Thus, if it's true that the evil Yetzer led to the fall, it also led to history, and therefore to the promise of a messianic kingdom of peace on earth, or for Christians, the incarnation and resurrection and the second coming. For the Jews, the messianic kingdom. And if it is true that Cain reprimands Yahweh, as we saw, for creating him with the evil desire, causing him to covet his brother's blessings and ultimately to kill him, a common rabbinical defense of Yahweh here is that God created us free and that we therefore have the liberty to choose whether we follow the evil or the good drives of the heart, that is the Yetzer Hara or the Yetzer Hatov. Likewise, if it's true that Enosh, the first idolater, and Aaron, Moses' brother, used the Yetzer to create idols and false gods, golden calves and whatnot, the prophets and psalmists used the erotic imagination to create divinely inspired narratives of salvation, mercy, and justice. In his book Good and Evil, the modern Jewish philosopher, Martin Buber, offers this illuminating gloss on the activation of the Yetzer. I quote, "The curse conceals a blessing. From the seat that had been made ready for him, man is now sent out upon a path, his own, the human path. This is the path to the world's history, and only through it does the world have a history and an historical goal, the kingdom." So without the activation of the Yetzer, there would have been no fall, but there would also be no historical promise and covenant and progress towards the kingdom. Or as Buber explains later in the book, once the desire of the heart is activated, one is no longer content with what one is. One strives for what one might be or could be or should be, the realm of the possible. The future tense of history enters human consciousness the moment the Yetzer of desiring imagination is ignited. This is why Joel praises the Yetzer as the hidden one in the heart of man. And one Talmudic source even claims that God preferred the songs of humans over the songs of the angels because only the former possessed the desire of the Yetzer. It's for this reason that Buber argues that Judaism sees evil as an anthropological rather than a cosmological condition of humanity. Evil is not some cosmic force that pre-exists the human and somehow overpowers and takes possession of us. Evil, like good, must be seen in terms of human beings' free decisions. Our desires, good or evil, are our responsibility, not God's. Thus, as Buber explains, quote, "If the Yetzer in a measure displaces Satan in the rabbinical account of sin, it must be regarded as a movement in the direction of a more ethical and rational conception. For the Yetzer, however vividly it's personified, always remains the tendency or disposition of a man's heart." And in fact, it was said that there were two directions of the heart, the outward direction and the inward direction. And one was the direction of evil and the other the direction of good. But the two seeds of the heart, the two directions of the heart, this was pretty fundamental to the original rabbinical view. I continue Buber's quote, "Satan cannot be appealed to for the purpose of explaining the origin of evil desire. God made the good Yetzer also, and man is responsible for the evil, or at least for its persistence. Or the evil Yetzer is perhaps itself good, or at least inevitable in the world, and men are to turn it to good purposes." End of quote. Indeed, some interpreters go so far as to suggest that the reason God did not create on the seventh day was not out of some perverse need for sabbatical self-congratulation, but because he wanted to leave that ultimate phase of creation free for humans to complete. In short, the kingdom of messianic justice is something that humans are called to co-create with God. Buber concludes accordingly that the Yetzer is potentially evil and potentially good. I quote, "In the midst of it, our decisions can arouse the heart's willing direction towards him, God, master the vortex of the possible and realize the human figure proposed in creation as it could not have done prior to the knowledge of good and evil. Greatest danger and greatest opportunity at once. To unite the two urges implies to equip the absolute potency of passion with the one direction that renders it capable of great love and great service. Thus, and not otherwise, can man become whole." Whence the command, according to Buber, to love God with one's whole heart, not with half of it, but all of it, meaning with the entirety of one's desiring being. It is no doubt within this tradition of affirmative interpretation that we can best locate the erotics of the Song of Songs. And this is what I want to now spend some time on, really for the remainder of the paper, before I conclude. For it's here, in this text, that we find not only human desire that is unashamedly celebrated, but divine desire as well. Something perhaps unthinkable in a Platonic framework, or in the negative theological tradition we outlined at the beginning. Indeed, we might be wiser when we approach this text to talk of a desire that is at once human and divine. The Song of Songs testifies, it seems, to an eros that is at once meontological, that is, moving from lack, meon, to fulfillment, and eschatological, moving from surplus and gratuity and superabundance towards lack and lessness. The at once here is all important because it's not, I'm going to suggest, a matter of either or. It is both desire ascending and descending. Desire ascending from lack to fulfillment, and descending from surplus and fulfillment towards the least of these, Alakistos. Let's look a little more closely at this revolutionary text, which has caused so much controversy and debate over the centuries in both the Jewish and the Christian traditions, but has never actually been banned, despite several attempts. Here, Eras is characterized not as a source of evil, but as the ultimate source of good. The lover's discourse in the Song of Songs testifies to the traversing of sexuality and sensuality by transcendence. On the one hand, we have Solomon, the shepherd, the beloved, the king, who compares the bridegroom, who compares his beloved's breasts to two fawns, twins of a gazelle, while she, the lover, the shepherdess, the Shulamite, the bride, compares his eyes to doves at a pool of water. So we're straight into very carnal images. On the other hand, the amorous passion serves as a trace testifying to the unnameable alterity of God. There's even a telling allusion at one point to the burning bush episode of Exodus 3:14. I'm thinking of the beloved's claim that, quote, love is as strong as death. The flash of it is a flash of fire, a flame of Yahweh himself. So there's a suggestion there that a lot of the rabbinical interpreters took up, that really the bridegroom is God. Although God is never named, per se, in the Song of Songs. The transfiguring fire of the burning bush here becomes the fire of a devouring desire. The Shulamite woman tells us that she is sick with love. Here the ecstasy of the beloved crosses over with the incarnational love of the divine. And in this crisscrossing of divine lover and human beloved, both are transfigured. Divine desire is embodied, and human desire is hallowed. So when I say incarnational, I don't necessarily presuppose a Christian perspective. The Song of Songs is pre-Christian, and it is incarnational. In Exodus 3, if Exodus 3:14 allowed of a God speaking through an angel and a burning thorn bush, the Song of Songs amplifies the range of divine speech to include lovers' bodies and, by analogy, entire landscapes. The landscapes, in turn, are brimming with fruits, nuts, figs, pomegranates, harvests, honey, wheat, wine, plants, lilies, cedars, roses, apple trees, and animals, gazelles, stags, and turtle doves. Quite a menagerie on every page. The divine desire of Yahweh's flame here appears to embrace all that is alive, as though the seed of the thorn bush has spread from the dusty heights of Mount Horeb, where Moses confronted the burning bush, and now disseminated its fecundity throughout the valleys and the plains below. But above all, the seed has found its way into the embrace of lover and beloved. The free love celebrated in this song challenges the cheerless moralism of tribal legalities. The Shulamite's proprietal brothers, for example, oppose the relationship between bride and bridegroom. And so doing, it miraculously echoes the innocence of Eros prior to the fall, when God made the first lovers of one flesh and declared it good, in Genesis 2. The influential 19th century rabbinical and Kabbalistic scholar Chaim de Wolitzin, who had such an influence on Emmanuel Levinas and other contemporary Jewish thinkers, spoke of the Song of Songs in terms of this double movement, back to Genesis and Exodus on the one hand, and then forward to the Messianic era, or eschatology. And he actually interprets the famous apostrophe that opens the Song of Songs, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth," a verse that Bernard of Clairvaux spent, I think it was 50 sermons trying to extrapolate. But he takes this famous apostrophe, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth," as a plea that the exotic revelation of Mount Sinai may eventually be given directly through the mouth of the lover. No longer, as it were, obscurely through a voice disguised as an angel or a burning bush or the back of God's head, but mouth to mouth. As carnal as it gets. And he goes on to take the verse 5:2, "My dove, my perfect one," as an indication of God's deep association with the universe of creatures, and more precisely, of his eschatological, quote, orientation towards the creation of worlds and his union with them. So it's kind of the dove as a promissory note for a new creation. The dove of of Noah, obviously Noah's Ark. For Christians, that would also include the allusion to the dove of the Pentecost, and so on. For Wolitzin, The Song of Songs is really a celebration of creation as God's body. All right. There's also a sense in which this text, I've been talking about the eschatological dimension, the leap forward of theoretics, but there's also a subversive or iconoclastic tenor to the verse. We'd be mistaken, I think, to see this subversiveness as somehow turning the lovers into cardboard characters of some kind of allegory, however. The lovers are not mouthpieces for some spiritual message, although there are a whole host of, and a whole tradition of allegorical readings that suggest, you know, it's not really about a lover and a beloved. You know, the body is simply an allegory for Christ and the church, or Yahweh and his people, or the soul and the divine. But it's not really about bodies. That's just a mistake, sort of an accident. So we've got to, you know, read through the carnality of the poem to the abstract allegory that resides behind it. A bit like Diotima's Ladder, you know, you kick it away once you've got your audience in, you say, you know, do you want a sexy poem? And they all think it's about sex, and then they discover it's not about sex at all, it's really about God. But you got them at that stage, so, you know, that's the important thing. It's a pedagogical ploy. So my argument or counter-argument to that allegorical interpretation is that the lovers are not mouthpieces or cardboard characters for some message. They are more than personifications or representations of Yahweh's continuing love for Israel or Christ's continuing love for the church. These things too, perhaps. I mean, when you enter the hermeneutic field of a work like the Song of Songs, all interpretations are permitted. But these became the canonical ones that tended to censor and sideline the other ones. There's much more to the Song of Songs than that. The lovers come across as carnal embodiments of a desire which traverses and exceeds them while remaining utterly themselves. Hence the candid corporality of recurring references to limbs, mouths, breasts, hands, and navels, etc. Not to mention the sense of deep inner yearning and the sheer naturality of description, which brings Eros to vivid life. The woman is a lily, a garden, a mare, a vineyard, a dove, sun, moon, while the lover is a gazelle, king, fawn, shepherd, bag of myrrh, and cluster of blossoming henna. The powerfully erotic charge of many of the amorous verses and metaphors defies any purely allegorical interpretation. Here's some samples. Try and allegorize them if you can. His left arm is under my head, and his right makes love to me. He pastures his flock among the lilies. His fountain makes the garden fertile. Or my beloved thrust his hand through the hole in the door. I trembled to the core of my being. Well, maybe it is Christ in the church, but it could have been said otherwise. This kind of language was, according to André Lecoq, almost unprecedented in the Bible, and it was to prove so controversial in the later rabbinical and Christian traditions as to be frequently laundered, chastened, or simply censored. Indeed, as a certain ascetic and puritanical mindset took hold, the Song of Songs was often explained away in terms of a Platonizing dualism, which contrived to take the harm out of its sensual, sexual, sensible content by attributing its real meaning to some supersensible metaphysical message. A reading typified, for example, in the refrain, "Wisdom, not love, is divine." This is really about wisdom, Sophia. It's not about Eros. So let's not get confused. Equally unique in this biblical song is the fact that divine love finds privileged expression in the voice of a young woman. It's the Shulamite who takes most of the initiative in the song and does most of the talking. And if the lover king, Solomon, speaks at some length in his own voice, his discourse often quotes and refers back again and again to the Shulamite as a source of reference, as a principal source of reference. This is, as Lecoq argues with Paul Ricoeur, in his book, Thinking Biblically, or their book, it's a woman's song from first to last, and it keeps the heroine center stage. Moreover, since this freedom and centrality of the woman's point of view suggests an Egyptian influence, according to Lecoq, one might even see the song as an extension of God's exotic flame, that is, an amplification of the voice of the burning bush which pitted Israel against Egypt, to a more inclusive voice, which brings them together again in some kind of actual or promised nuptial bond. So, some concluding remarks. The Song of Songs, I would conclude, offers an erotic poetics which tries to sing the unsayable and intimate the unnameable by means of a very innovative language and a very insubordinate language, a language that resists the allegorical attempts to turn it into a mere message. There's a surplus of meaning in the text where language mutates and names and verbs and nouns proliferate and displace each other almost metonymically. All of this indicates that burning, integrated, faithful, untiring desire, freed from social or inherited repressions, is perhaps the most adequate way for saying how human desire God, humans desire God, and God desires humans, and humans desire each other. This sort of hermeneutic proliferation of the language itself and the tropology and the metaphorics of the text suggests that human and divine desire may reflect and transfigure one another and move from dissimilarity, if you think of Kant's analogy of faith, from, you know, quite dissimilar things, as he puts it, divinity and carnality, towards some similarity of relations, some kind of metaphorical convergence or interanimation between these supposedly opposite realms. Suddenly they are traversing each other in this very radical way. This is a controversial reading, but it is not limited to contemporary interpreters like Julia Kristeva in Tales of Love, which I'll come to in a moment, or Ricoeur and Lecoq, or indeed Wallerstein in the 19th century. It goes all the way back to some of the ancient rabbis, one in particular, Rabbi Akiba, who said that of all the scriptures are holy, the Song of Songs is the holiest of holies. Kristeva, in the Tales of Love, in her book Tales of Love, she has a chapter on the Song of Songs, where she says that the multiplicity of names for the unnameable, lover and beloved, they all have different names, as you've probably gathered. There's a shepherd, the king, Solomon, bridegroom, and so on. There's the shepherdess, the Shulamite, the bridegroom. And then, you know, she's a mare, and she's compared to various fruits and various animals and various plants. So there's this sort of overflowing of meaning, this hyper-nomination. Or as Kristeva puts it, a flow of significations and sensations comparable to that produced by caresses, perfumes, and oils. The sensitive and the significant, the body and the name, are thus not only placed on the same level, but fused in the same logic of undecidable infinitization. We have here, she says, a semantic polyvalence brewed by the state of love. And she goes on with this comparison to sort of between intoxication and language, that's sort of a linguistic inebriation. And there are certain texts, she doesn't refer to them, but one could refer to them, where this sort of inebriation of language and love is very much to the fore. I think, for example, of Augustine in Confessions, Book 6. We saw the Augustine on evil desire, the lust of the eyes. But it's also Augustine who writes about desire, "You shed your fragrance about me. I drew breath and now I gasp for your sweet odor. I tasted you and now I hunger and thirst for you. You touched me and I'm inflamed with love." That's Augustine talking about his God. Another example here in this tradition of linguistic and erotic inebriation is John of the Cross, a saint in the Catholic tradition, who in the Spiritual Canticle writes, commenting on the Song of Songs, "The bride enjoys habitual peace in the visits of her beloved and sometimes has a sublime enjoyment of their sweetness and fragrance. The soul feels that the beloved is within her as in his own bed. With the wine of love, the beloved causes divine inebriation. By its strength, the soul directs towards God sweet and delightful outpourings. The touch of the spark by which you awaken the soul and the spiced wine by which you, God, the beloved, inebriate her, cause her, the bride, to direct to you the flowings of the movements and acts of love that you have caused in her." So, again, you can see the proliferation and efflorescence of language and naming, even to the point of a heady brew of intoxication. What I want to suggest is, in the Song of Songs and in some of these other texts, you've got a mixing of the human and the divine. So that human desire, as experienced by humans, can be human and divine, can be eschatological and meontological, to the extent that it participates in the divine. And ditto if we're talking about an incarnational God, which I suggest we are, certainly in the Song of Songs. But let me move on after Plato to a text by the Pseudo-Denis, I'll quote it very briefly, in the Divine Names, where he brings together, it seems to me, the Neoplatonic tradition of the one emanating down, the divine one emanating down into immanence, into the world, into the flesh, and on the other hand, the Christian notion, the Judeo-Christian notion of incarnation. And he says here, you know, those who wish to slander the name of Eros, so he's used to people slandering Eros, he says they forget that Eros is good through the good. And he even says that the words Eros and Agape should not be separated out as Eros is bad, human desire, and Agape is good, you know, benevolent. Divine desire, eschatological desire, he says the two should be used synonymously. So he's upsetting that dualism. Eros, he says, I quote, is eminently a power of unifying, binding, and joining. Before subsisting, it is in the beautiful and good on account of the beautiful and good. It is given forth from out of the beautiful and good on account of the beautiful and good. Very Platonic language. Moreover, the divine Eros is ecstatic. It does not permit lovers to be amongst themselves. No lover can be left on his or her own, but bids them to be amongst lovers. Flowing forth out of the good to beings, returning again into the good, in this the divine Eros is excellently manifested. To be without beginning and without end, the divine Eros is like an everlasting circle. And I want to move finally from that everlasting circle of Neoplatonic, apophatic theoerotics to the final soliloquy of Molly Bloom, and time being what it is, I'll be very brief in quoting just a few lines, but I think you'll get the message. And what I'd like to suggest is that here in Molly Bloom we also find the coming together of Greek and Jew. Jew-Greek is Greek-Jew, woman's reason, as Joyce put it. The coming together of the meontological desire and the eschatological desire of the Song of Songs and, let's say, Phaedrus, book 13. Chapter 13. Molly, what else were we given all those desires for, I'd like to know? I can't help it if I'm still young. Of course, a woman wants to be embraced 20 times a day, almost to make her look young, no matter by who, so long as to be in love or loved by somebody. If the fellow you want isn't there, sometimes by the Lord God, I was thinking. And I thought, well, as well him as another. And then I asked him with my eyes to ask again yes. And then he asked me, would I say yes? To say yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breasts all perfume, yes. And his heart was going like mad. And yes, I said yes, I will yes.
Thank you very much for that wonderful elucidation of so many texts, both from the Greek and the Hebrew tradition, and from the side saying that Eros is good and the side saying that Eros is evil. I'm not quite sure what I should do to comment on this. I could add more texts, but I think what I'll do instead is to preach the last part of a sermon. This is now a different genre. This is not reading French phenomenology through Irish eyes. It's a plain old American sermon. It's a sermon on the prophets, on the book of Hosea. Now, Hosea seems not to be sexy. Hosea was an uptight fellow, not a very nice person. He was told by God that he ought to marry a whore and then write about the experience. So he married this prostitute named Gomer. I'm just summarizing this a little bit in case you haven't read Hosea recently. He married this prostitute who kept going out and plying her trade, and she became pregnant three times and brought the kids back home, and old Hosea had to raise the kids. And he welcomed her back home because he had promised God that he was going to be like God, who was going to keep his promises to love wanton Israel. That's the point. Israel had whored after other gods, and Hosea was supposed to tell the people in his writings that God still was going to stay the lover of Israel. The language of this is wild, the language of Hosea. Half the time he's talking about his own feelings about this whoring wife. Half the time he's speaking in God's name, talking about what God is going to do to Ephraim. That's the name of Judah in that work. It's very complicated stuff. There's a lot of gender crossing there. So the Israelites, the people of Ephraim, the leaders, those are all men leaders, and they are accused of women's crimes. And Yahweh, who is the big war god, who is now to be symbolized by Hosea, the righteous husband who keeps the house and sets the rules, Yahweh turns out to be a kind of a mothering god. I'll read a passage about that. So you're coming into the middle of a sermon here. As to Yahweh's gender identity, many of us take great comfort that the Yahweh of storms and tides, who overwhelmed Egypt under Moses and Canaan under Deborah, the warrior Yahweh of the Exodus, who rode a pillar of cloud by day and fire by night, the monarchical Yahweh, who very grudgingly let Israel have a human king, has become a tender and forgiving husband. There's no great distance from Hosea's image of the merciful and provident divine husband of Israel to Jesus' intimate father. But in Hosea's prophecy, Yahweh is given the mothering, nurturing role of women, as well as the violent, retributive roles of men. That's how I read the beginning of chapter 11, which I'll read now. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and offering incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love. I was to them like those who lift infants to their cheeks. I bent down to them and fed them. Now, those of us men who are unwilling to concede the nurturing parental role to women alone are quite pleased with this as a description of masculine virtues. But it surely runs contrary to the ancient stereotypes. Many scholars have pointed out that Yahweh alone of the ancient Near Eastern gods combines the gender roles of both women and men. Unlike some current thinkers who assume that God thereby transcends and neutralizes gender roles, the ancient thought was that Yahweh embodied them both. So Hosea's Yahweh is not only the forgiving husband, but also the nurturing mother. An unappreciated Jewish mother, to be sure, but a mother nevertheless. Gender confusion and boundary crossing are disturbing ideas in any age, no less in ours, when our churches are racked by controversies over homosexuality and transgendered people. Therefore, we might well make the move of most interpreters of Hosea and take a step away from the immediacy of his sexual imagery and underscore a more general point, one that leads straight to the Christian gospel, if that's your direction. God is loving and faithful, no matter how much we sin. Even sin in the worst sexual betrayals in our inner hearts and apostasy in our family commitments, God comes after us to bring us home. Therefore, hope remains for the worst of us in our worst sins. No adultery, no crime of passion, no betrayal of those who love us, no unfair burdening of others, no forgetfulness of who we are, no failure of responsibilities, no perverse flaunting of the covenant, no deep longing for forbidden orgasm, no swarming thoughts of breaking boundaries can keep us from the redeeming love of God. How can we be worse than Gomer, the whore? We can't be. What could be more powerful than Hosea's image of the faithful husband who continues to love and always receive back his whoring wife, Gomer? Well, perhaps only the image of the loving father who sends his eldest true-born son to recover his lost children at the price of his own life. Hosea's imagery of love and family sets the metaphoric context for Paul's and John's imagery of family love ratcheted up in suffering and sacrifice to a level of greater intensity. We cannot understand the symbols of Jesus as the Son of God, sacrificed for the sins of the world, except as building explicitly on Hosea's symbols of divine family love. That generalized lesson of divine love for wayward people is a foundation stone for Christian life and love. But something important is lost when we retreat from the immediacy of Hosea's sexual imagery. If you read the whole of the book, you'll see something wild and irrational about it. One moment, God is pleading for whoring Israel to return. The next moment, crying desperate and total violence against Israel. And then, without reason, turning to promises of reconciliation and fullness of life. God tells the children to plead with their mother to turn from her whoring and take, I quote, her adultery from between her breasts, or I will strip her naked and expose her as in the day that she was born. Upon her children also will I have no pity, because they are the children of whoredom. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them. She shall seek them, but shall not find them. I will punish her for the festival days of the Baals, when she offered incense to them and decked herself with her ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, says the Lord. Therefore, I will now allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There she shall respond as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. And I will have pity on Lo Ruhamah, a child, and I will say to Lo Ami, another child, you are my people, and he shall say, you are my God. That's love talking. Passionate, jealous, angry, sexual love. It's not measured. Its hold on justice is insecure. Yahweh's passion betrays a devastated husband, crying his grief, raging at his loss, anguished at betrayal, wounded, bleeding, in such pain as to threaten violence he does not mean, but so disordered as to be capable of it, breaking out against his beloved. You know how domestic violence can erupt from wounded love. Raise that to divine dimensions, and you can see the broken heart of Yahweh, crazed omnipotence with lightning bolts. Our Creator's like that. Not just a rational architect or a landscape gardener. Not just a nurturing mother or protective father, but a lover severed from his beloved and from his senses, madly making things in wild abandon. Hosea's point is that God's infinite passion, that wild love, more elemental than any marriage or moral contract, is still more steady and faithful than love based on justice. No matter what whoring we do, and what violence God wreaks upon us, God will make us his people again, and he shall be our beloved. We cannot get away because we are wildly, madly loved. One final point, one more turn on Hosea's texts. If I am right that Hosea's real depiction of divine love is in the wild swings between violent, vengeful rejection and the lavishing of gifts and welcome upon the beloved, then the allegorical identification of Yahweh with the husband Hosea is only superficial. There's a deeper identification. Who is the wild one in this text? It's Gomer. Who is the fruitful one? It's Gomer. Who loves everybody? It's Gomer. Who sets love above the rules? It's Gomer. But who treats people like possessions? Hosea. Who produces no children? Hosea. Who is the passive agent of others? Hosea. If God were domesticated and bound by the covenant, he would be like Hosea and receive back his beloved because of obligation. Surely the author means to say that Yahweh is something like this, being faithful to Israel despite betrayal because Yahweh had promised to be faithful. Deeper than this intention, however, Hosea's rhetoric says, promises be damned. God wants Israel back because he loves her and will give her anything to get her back. As Gomer went hunting her lovers when they could not be found, so Yahweh hunts fickle Israel. As Gomer was a sucker for the false charms of her lovers, so God will take our false hearts into her bosom. As Gomer roused her lovers from their indolence by her raw, sensual love, so God will melt our hearts and rouse us to passion that passes justice and measure. Hosea's symbol of sex deconstructs the husband's story of long-suffering justice without denying justice and repentance. Deeper than the justice of the covenant at Sinai, the mountain Yahweh almost broke to pieces when his holiness descended in fire and smoke to deliver the commandments, throbs the raw, wild love in creativity. We cannot bear much of that wild divine lover, and so we cover our own naked loving and longing for love with domestic stories like Hosea's long-suffering husband raising foster children. But sex knocks cracks in domestic theology and lets us glimpse the wild lover who says, promises be damned. I love you and will feed you with life until you run over. Sex's mad passion lets us glimpse the abandon of wild divinity in ourselves, too. Surely that needs to be tamed and civilized. Love can be violent and hurtful, and the covenant is a good thing. Justice and the peace of domestic measure are obligatory no matter what. But deep down, God's love is a little oblivious as to morals. And we are called to such a passion too, loving because that's who we are, God's and Gomer's children, daughters and sons of the divine nature, loving our world into existence in wild abandon. My question for you all is whether that's a good God or a bad God. Thank you.
Well, I won't be so bold as to try and answer that final question, but there was a wonderful response, greatly in excess of what you were responding to.
That's the point, I guess.
Excess. That wild abandon. It struck me as a terrific example of hermeneutic imagination at work in and with a biblical text. And I think it's the language of texts like Hosea and the Song of Songs are similar in that they can invite that kind of reading, and then suddenly the reading is turned around and we discover that, you know, instead of Hosea necessarily being the good guy and the right guy and the just guy, you know, Gomer has her say. And this kind of reversibility is, it seems to me, very good for the soul and very good for reason, because it is nurtured by imagination, and imagination has a wilder abandon and a certain poetic license which sometimes critical reason doesn't have. So I think hermeneutics has that kind of dual fidelity to sort of rational, scientific unpacking of texts with all the available scholarship, and yet that ability to go into a text as Robert just did with Hosea. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture entitled Desire and the Problem of Evil, part of a series of lectures focusing on the topic of evil, presented by the Institute for Philosophy and Religion and sponsored by the Boston University Humanities Foundation and the Boston University Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. Our main speaker was Richard Carney, Selig Chair of Philosophy at Boston College and visiting professor at University College Dublin. Responding to Professor Carney was Robert C. Neville, Professor of Philosophy, Religion, and Theology, and Dean of Marsh Chapel at Boston University. We began with an introduction by Klaus Brinkmann, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Acting Chairman of the Philosophy Department at Boston University. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog and Vince Fairchild. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.